Hello, Roy here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to The Roy Green Show ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Welcome to The Roy Green Show podcast.
We'll start the program with the issue of the radical anti-Semitism that exists in this country, and it's very, very disturbing. Just want to let you know, in case you hadn't heard the story, that a Toronto man who was charged with first-degree murder for running over a Toronto police officer has today been found not guilty by the jury. Umar Zamir pleaded not guilty to first-degree murder in the death of Detective Constable Jeffrey Northrup, who died on the 2nd of July in 2021 after he was hit by a vehicle in an underground parking garage at Toronto City Hall. The facts that Mr. Zamir ran over Detective Constable Northrup and caused his death, they were not in dispute. The case centered on whether Mr. Zamir meant to hit the detective constable or even knew that it had happened, and whether he knew that the detective constable, Northrup, and his partner, who were in plain clothes, were police officers. Prosecutors had alleged Mr. Zamir knew Northrup was an officer and drove directly at him, but the defense countered that Mr. Zamir thought he and his family were being attacked by robbers and tried to escape in the safest way possible. So it was the fourth day of deliberation, during which the jury had asked three questions. They have found Mr. Zamir not guilty. Let's talk about what's going on as far as the anti-Semitic realities in this country are concerned. And it's worldwide. As we've spoken about with Ambassador Moed and with the former Canadian ambassador to Israel, Vivian Berkovich, and others on this program. But it is becoming increasingly dangerous, increasingly deeply reflective of a problem in our society, a significant issue in our society. Columbia University, by the way, an Ivy League school, a rabbi there just today, has advised Jewish students to leave the university and not come back until the situation changes appreciably, because he expresses great concern for the safety of Jewish students. We spoke with Professor Eric Kam, and one of his students from Toronto Metropolitan University 2 weeks ago about this very issue. And the Jewish student had deep concern about her safety until she had her first conversation with Dr. Kam. Op-ed in the Toronto Sun, anti-Israel protesters becoming more radical, openly embracing terror groups. And the op-ed is by Warren Kinsella. Warren was special assistant to Jean Chrétien, now president and CEO of the Daisy Group, crisis management and communications firm, at Warren Kinsella on Twitter/X. He joins us. Warren, this is just becoming worse and worse, more and more disturbing, more and more troublesome. And there was a report, I believe it was B'nai B'rith, that said, now we're at a stage where synagogues are vandalized and it doesn't even make the news.
Yeah, and then we have people in Ottawa marching in front of our seat of government, cheering the events of October 7th, cheering the barbarity that took place in Israel on that day. So, Roy, I've got today in Post Media papers, I was given a document that was authored by a group called Palestine Action, and they're mainly centered in Britain, but they're active elsewhere. They're kind of a network. And it reads like a terror manual. It reads it's a manual about how to commit violence and vandalism and break the law and get away with it, you know, all in the name of being against Israel. But of course, when you read it, when you see it, you realize it's not just against Israel, it's against democracy, it's against the West, and it's against, you know, everything that we hold dear.
Yeah, I was reading your piece on that, and they actually instruct their operatives or would-be operatives, their cells, on how to proceed and how to avoid police investigation or suspicion. It's a how-to manual.
It is. You know, they talk about planning action. Here's a quote. You know, how smashing windows and exterior equipment is advised. Blocking companies' external pipes using concrete, as, by the way, some anti-Israel protesters did in Toronto on some railway tracks this week. is going to cause disruption. They talk about breaking in to buildings and damaging the contents, which they say is a very effective tactic. And they talk about how to get away, how to make sure that you're disguised, that, you know, your face is covered. You know, even they give advice about what shoe to wear. They say, keep the police pay attention to the shoes. And then, you know, never leave anything behind, apart from paint and destruction, end quote. And because police may try to forensically analyze whatever's there. When you read this thing, it's like they're beyond where they were, Roy. They have fully embraced violence and criminality, and they're getting more and more bold and brazen.
Yeah. And let's keep in mind, and let's keep the focus as well on the fact, not just you and I, everybody, that when we're talking about Jewish Canadians, we're talking about exactly that, Jewish Canadians. We're talking about our fellow citizens. We're talking about multi-generational families that have contributed tremendously to the growth and success of this country and their kids. And now they live in fear. And it's intolerable. And what we've received, as far as the Prime Minister is concerned and this government is concerned, has been totally unsatisfactory, even to the point where the ambassador told us that things have changed between Israel and Canada. And an envoy from the Foreign Ministry of Israel told us last weekend that Mr. Trudeau had chosen the wrong path. So there's not real leadership on this issue coming from Ottawa.
No, there is not. And, you know, if you look at it, there's all kinds of metrics, ways you can measure it. And the Brits have a big problem. The French have a big problem. But the country that has one of the worst problems for anti-Semitism on the planet is Canada. And a big part of that, you know, our police and prosecutors haven't done a very effective job, but our politicians haven't either. And, it, you know, getting back to the point you made just a minute ago, like sometimes you have to give your head a shake. It's like we're talking about these mobs, these cabals attacking Jews, our fellow citizens, you know, our brothers and sisters in this country, attacking them because of the decisions that are made by a foreign government in Israel. It's just madness. Like, in what way are they to blame? In what way is it fair to attack a citizen of Canada for a decision that's made by the government of Israel? But, you know, sadly, we're just seeing it now in this country just about every single day. And as I say, they're getting more and more bold.
Yeah. And I've heard the argument made, Warren, but this is post October 7th of last year. It's more than that. This attitude, a vile antagonism toward Jewish Canadians has clearly existed and just under the radar for much longer than the last 7 months.
Yeah, well, you know, you've had me on over the years, and, you know, I've been writing about the far right and racist groups and the far left and anti-Semitism for more than 30 years. And it's always been there. You know, it's always, sadly, it never fully goes away. But I've never seen it as bad as it is now. You know, schools, like day schools for little kids, Jewish kids, being shot up not once but twice in Montreal. A Jewish delicatessen in Toronto being firebombed. People's homes, Jewish homes in Winnipeg being shot up. Vandalism and threats. Like this week, I went out with my agent, my literary agent. We were celebrating. I've signed to do a book globally for Random House about what we're talking about. And the owner of the restaurant, I've been going to it for years. It's delicatessen. She said, I got to show you something. And Roy, on her door, she'd come in early to get, you know, ready for the day. And somebody had written the word Juden, which is German for Jew, on the door. It wasn't the worst part. The worst part was when she called, you know, the graffiti removal people to get it taken down, they said she'd have to wait a couple days.
The fact that the fans have done this, like the the breaking of the records and the yes. going out to the stores and getting it. It's like, you know, I'm 32, so we're considered geriatric pop stars.
No, I don't think so.
They start trying to put us out to pasture at age 25. Yeah. I'm just happy to be here.
The domination of pop music by Taylor Swift. There was Taylor with Jimmy Fallon and a whole bunch of people. And as you know, if you're a Swiftie or if you're following pop music at all, the new release by Taylor Swift, Tortured Poets Department, with 15 unexpected tracks, is available. So one of the questions I'm asking, because, you know, she said geriatric, one of the questions I'm asking for my generation is, why Taylor Swift? Other acts who matched or came close to matching her appeal, current and or past, who are they? And her legion of international Swifties fans, who are you? We're going to get into all of this. And joining us is Alan Cross, host of the syndicated The Ongoing History of New Music and a Journal of Musical Things with a new podcast, Uncharted Crime and Mayhem in the Music Industry. Alan, thank you so much for making time. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you.
Good to talk to you. First of all, congratulations, of course, on your great success and terrific work in keeping music and the history of new music front and center for so many of us. And I remember the conversations you and I used to have in the hallway, and I'm still at the radio station in Hamilton, but we had some great chats. Taylor Swift's rise, how does it compare to other pop rock acts? Who's the only possible, or is there more than one possible comparison?
Well, here's the thing. You can't assume that the pop environment has been static and always been the same since rock and roll and pop music, modern pop music, was born in the 1950s. Everything has changed from the way people consume music to the way people are paid for music to the way music is marketed. It's a completely different beast. And a lot of people will want to compare Taylor Swift to the Beatles. And that is okay to a certain extent if you use metrics that the Beatles used when it came to selling records, charting records, having reactions from fans. But it's much different these days. So while she is, and I'm not going to take it away from her, she is a once-in-a-generation talent who is tremendously prolific in terms of the music that she puts out, tremendously energetic in the number of concerts, big concerts, long concerts she plays. It's a different beast. Back then, the Beatles had Brian Epstein, their manager, and radio was the only way to really get this sort of music out to the masses. Today, Taylor Swift has a much more sophisticated marketing team behind her. She has social media behind her. The rules for, she has streaming behind her. The rules for compiling charts are different than in the Beatles days. So in many ways, it's an apples and oranges comparison. That's not to take anything away from Taylor Swift and what she has done today, but to say that she's bigger than the Beatles or like the Beatles is a bit of a misnomer.
Okay. So why Taylor Swift? What is it about Taylor Swift that makes her such a hugely appealing and successful performer?
Well, first of all, talent, I'll give you that. Secondly, image. Third, she has a knack of connecting with fans. I was at a seminar many years ago at a music conference in the Far East, and there was a discussion about Taylor Swift's lyrics. And one of the things that this person pointed out was that Taylor uses the word you a lot in her lyrics. And by using the word you, it really personalizes things. It really makes the emotional message of the song a lot more connective. So that's something that helps. Secondly, she benefits from help from a lot of different songwriters, co-songwriters, producers, that you know, to augment her talent. So that's something else. And again, you got to go back to this business of marketing and promotion. She has a publicist by the name of Tree Payne. Tree has been with her for a very long time. Nobody gets to Taylor without going through Tree. And everything that you hear about Taylor goes through Tree. It's highly regulated, very, very smartly executed, and just generally incredibly sophisticated. So that helps as well.
Now, I want to ask you about the fans, the Swifties. Let me back up a little bit. I saw Springsteen in New York City 2 years ago for his one-man Springsteen on Broadway show, and fans massed outside the theater when the show was over. And Springsteen drove out, and I just expected him to disappear. But the big SUV stopped. Bruce Springsteen got out, stood on the door frame, Alan, and I'm sure you've probably seen this, and exchanged conversation for about 20 minutes to half an hour with the fans who were standing there. Some of them he recognized who've been following him. I think they call them tramps, don't they? They've been following him for years. There was this incredible interplay between Springsteen and his fans. Now, this is a long journey to get from the boss first appearing to where he is now. Does Taylor Swift have the same potential relationship with her fans?
Well, she does it, but at a distance. You know, she will find some fan, deserving super fan, that needs medical bills paid or needs something done for them in their lives, and she'll take care of that. We hear stories about the big bonuses that she gave her road crew because the Eras tour was so successful. So there is that, and I'm sure it's heartfelt. I'm sure it comes from the right place. But you know, again, it's you know we hear about it, and oh, look what a wonderful woman she is. Look what she did for her people. Look what she did for this fan. And you know, that's all part of it. Again, I'm not taking anything away from her talent. I'm just saying that whenever she does something like that, we know about it. And that contributes to her overall image.
Yeah, it's quite the phenomenon. And I'm going to start listening more. I've got a wide spectrum of music that I listen to. I haven't been listening to Taylor Swift, but I'm going to give it a really solid try going forward. It wouldn't be complete though if I didn't ask you for your thoughts on the Travis Kelce situation or the interaction with the yeah, Kansas City Chiefs tight end.
She basically took over the NFL.
She did, yeah.
And you know, it's if you had to, and I'm sure this relationship is 100% real, but again, it was stage managed. At least the information about the relationship was stage managed in such a perfect way on both sides, so that you only got the good stuff. You know, and it's. For the entire NFL season, I mean, it was a fairy tale thing where, you know, she had the boyfriend who was a big football star. They go all the way to the Super Bowl. He has a really great game in the Super Bowl. She was seen in the luxury boxes and so on. Her average appearance in a game was less than 30 seconds on camera. You really didn't see her a lot, but you saw her just enough. Again, to have this all stage managed, and the NFL was completely complicit in it, and they loved it because it brought in a lot of new viewers, female viewers under the age of 24. So a lot of young girls started this past year watching football with their dads or their moms or whoever because of the Taylor Swift connection. And again, it was played out marvelously. One thing that I do want people to notice is that where is all the critical coverage of Taylor Swift? You know, you don't even, you don't hear any bad things. You don't hear any missteps. You don't hear any, you know, scandalous things that could have happened. It's, and I'm sure that there's something out there that the paparazzi would love to glom onto and the tabloids would love to glom onto, but you don't hear it. And again, the question is, how in this day and age, how do you keep any bad stuff or any potentially bad stuff that could be spun into something out of the public eye? It's quite amazing.
It is, because it happens to so many others who have very high profile careers internationally. And all of a sudden you find out, And we're off chasing down the alleyway, chasing that story about that certain individual. I thank you for coming on. I can't let you go, though, without you telling us about your new podcast, Uncharted Crime and Mayhem in the Music Industry. Tell us about that, please.
True crime is the biggest category in terms of podcasts. And when we were looking for something new to do, podcasts that were available, or topics that were available, and we realized that there are very few, if any, true crime podcasts that deal with the world of music. So it seemed to be like a no-brainer for us to go down that particular route. And there were a lot of stories. I'm about to start on one that will deal with the whole Phil Spector situation, where, you know, Lana Clark and all that. There's a story about Led Zeppelin having $200,000 disappearing from a hotel room, and nobody's ever been prosecuted, but I think we've solved that particular crime. There was the Satanic Panic of the 1980s was a big one. The next one that's coming up in about 10 days will deal with the music of Charles Manson. And there is an amazing musical background to Manson and the family that a lot of people don't know about. That's the kind of thing that we explore.
I had said that we would have an opportunity to speak with the Swifty, one of the, that's what the fans call themselves. And the Swifty in question, her first name is Taylor, go figure. And her brother, Tom, is the technical producer for this program, and he's on the other side of the glass. Taylor, how are you?
I'm doing great today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Before we bring your brother into this, how excited were you? How dramatically important is it for Swifties when a new disc comes out, as it were, a new album, and then it has the additional 15 songs nobody was expecting?
It's always a production leading into something new like this, and we have definitely been spoiled in the last little bit with all the concerts and the content, and I think Swifties in particular knew this was a big one with all of the drama she has been through in her life in the last few years. So there was lots of excitement, and to be honest, myself, I kind of knew there was going to be something a little extra. She always does something you're not expecting. So I remember I stayed up, you know, to midnight to listen to the first album, went to bed, woke up, and there was a whole new album. And I was like, I knew I should have stayed up till two. That's on me.
Did you remember why it is and how it is you became involved with Taylor Swift, how you became a Swifty?
I'm 30 now for context. I was 14 when I first heard her music. And I was in high school, and it was just so much fun, and it was country, and it was just something that really sat with me as a 14-year-old. I think one of the things she does really well is write lyrics that no matter what mood you're in, no matter what stage of life you're in, really relate to you. And from there on, you know, I've had my ups and downs. I've had albums I didn't like. I've had albums I've loved, but I've just kind of been a part of it since then.
Well, let's bring your brother Tom into the conversation here. And Tom was telling me, while it was going on, by the way, how you and the entire family engaged on a project for you to get tickets to see Taylor Swift, and it worked out. Hey, Tom.
Yep, it was quite the production. I swear I was mostly focusing on the show while that was going on.
Thank you.
You know,
appreciate that. So, what did you guys do? Because it was a lottery, wasn't it? It was a big deal. You had to be lucky to get, or very determined and lucky to get the tickets.
Oh, it was a production yet again. I think I probably had close to like 20, 25 different emails signed up through people I knew. And I had just kind of given everyone the rundown on, if you get a code, this is what we need to do. This is the time you need to block off. And everyone was very kind and very excited for this opportunity as well. And my mom ended up being the person who got the code. Out of all those emails, only one person got a code. And she was able to give me access to her Ticketmaster account. And even then, when you get the code and you get in, you're not guaranteed tickets. And we were very lucky to kind of get in last minute and click around for a little bit until magically two tickets appeared. And I worked my quickest to get them paid for and closed in.
Yeah, your brother's got a big smile on his face. Israeli. Talk to your sister.
Yeah. So how excited are you for the concert, Taylor?
Oh, well, I'm incredibly excited. I did see her in New York when she was in New York. Right. And one of the reasons we wanted to get tickets to see her again is, one, because it's an incredible show. Two, my husband didn't get to see her. And in this process, I think he's become a Swiftie and he was really interested in seeing the concert. And three, I just knew the moment she released a new album, there was going to be new music coming through in this concert. So it's almost like an entirely new experience getting to experience all these new songs as well.
Well, I never thought that I would have the opportunity to speak to a Swiftie, but here we are. This has just happened spontaneously. I said to Tom when I came into the studio, do you think your sister would talk to us on the air? And you worked it out. And Taylor, thank you so much for taking the time. I'm sure you'll just have a terrific time at the concert. And your brother's a good guy, because you knew that.
I like him.
You knew that. Thank you, Taylor.
Thanks, sis.
Thank you very much.
What are your credentials for this job?
Well, I would say my credentials is for going back for this last 30 years. I've shoplifted in the best stores, Harrods, Selfridges, the Army and Navy, Gorringes. I don't think there's a store that I haven't done. As a matter of fact, I've probably gone up one side of Bond Street and down the other.
What sort of things have you managed to get away with?
Oh, diamond rings, gold cigarette cases, mink coats, things like this, Persian lamb and cashmere costumes, things like that, and watches, Omegas, all the best, Philip Petit watches, and all the good stuff.
It sounds like something from Monty Python or some takeoff on shoplifting. That's a real story. That's from a British television program where they interviewed the top shoplifters. And this guy had been doing it, as you heard him say, for 30 years. And it's a growth industry from what I understand. And our good friend, Professor Sylvain Charlebois, food professor, posted to, at Food Professor, posted to X and Twitter about online posters and calls to organize a, quote, Steal from Loblaws Day on the 12th of May. And Professor Charlebois reminds, this is not only ridiculous, it's criminal, and it is. And, I said earlier, and I posted this on X/Twitter as well, it's like trying to organize a national day of looting. Professor Sylvain Charlebois is the director of the Agri-Foods Lab at Dalhousie University. And he joins us. Sylvain, thank you for taking the time. This is one of the most crazy things that I've encountered.
We've seen signs of this for a while, for well over a year. I remember last year I actually wrote an op-ed about shoplifting, and of course the theory, of course, is if you shoplift, everyone pays. That's basically how it works. And I do remember that I was actually slammed by some people, anarchists really, believing that if something is too expensive, they have the right to steal it, basically, just because they truly believe that grocers are gouging. And if they're doing that, of course, it gives them the right to steal. That's the theory that they actually go by. But there is a group of extremists out there absolutely believing that shoplifting should be legalized, and it's really scary, and it's been growing over the last, I'd say, year and a half, and now there is this group on Reddit that is just galvanizing more support. And some people are, believing, and this is, if you're not familiar with Reddit, it's a bunch of echo chambers. They basically exclude people who are not supporting the narrative. So they just, build up a sentiment fueled with anger, basically. And the anger is against Loblaw, of course. And I'm not surprised to see all of this happening, but I have to tell you, Roy, I'm deeply concerned about our country and how we actually protect the virtues of a law state.
It is a very concerning situation. And at first I thought, like I said, I thought it was a spoof. But then I thought, you're not the kind of guy to shove out a spoof at people on a Sunday morning. And, no. You know, and I thought there has to be something behind this that has really gotten Sylvain's attention. A national day of, what are they calling it? National day of, I've got it here.
Shoplifting, I think.
Yeah, it's steal from Loblaws Day.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, first of all, why target only Loblaw?
Why,
if you actually look at price points, I mean, all grocers, we've seen prices go up everywhere, not just at Loblaw. So if you want to boycott, that's fine. But boycotting just one grocer makes little sense to me. And of course, when someone wants to boycott a grocer, to me, it means that they just can't read financial reports. If you actually take the time to look at financial reports, you'll see that grocers are making good money, record profits, nominal dollars, of course, but they are making money selling other things than food. Food is not the issue. I mean, if they are making money selling cosmetics, perfumes, clothing, things like that, but margins are extremely low when it comes to food. So that's the one thing that really bothers me. And as an academic for the last year and a half, I've been trying to educate Canadians on this issue. This week, I was actually with a reporter. I'm not going to tell you from which outlet, but I actually had to spend 45 minutes with that person explaining why a boycott is not necessarily a good idea. It took me four, and you can tell as I was explaining why, you could tell that he just didn't want to believe me. He just believed that a boycott was a good thing to put prices, to force grocers to set prices lower.
This is a reporter.
This is a reporter.
Wow.
From a well-known outlet.
Okay.
Not yours.
Not ours.
From a well-known outlet.
I didn't think it was ours, because if you're a reporter, when you go to someone like you for information, you listen to what you're told, and then you go and corroborate what you've been told if you need to. You don't get into a 45-minute debate about it.
I can tell you, Rob, to be honest, Roy, over the last year and a half, I feel some reporters actually have bought the issue of greedflation and the fact that grocers are gouging. They've bought into it. And so when they hear an academic say, well, there's no evidence of it, they just don't want to believe it. And so they cancel academics who do believe that there is no gouging going on. I mean, there are some issues in the grocery. We can go back to the bread cartel. And I mean, Loblaws is not an innocent child here, let's be honest. But at the same time, when you look at prices in Canada, there was an article in National Post, I think it was on Friday, explaining why food prices are actually okay compared to other places around the world. And so many, many academics have actually come to the conclusion that really we got lucky in Canada compared to other places around the world.
You know, Sylvain, what people also don't think about, maybe they don't care, but what they don't think about is when they set a date for something like a steal from Loblaws Day, what the potential consequences of such a situation are. If you get enough people who think, well, that's, you know, maybe, whatever, police are involved, innocent people are involved, any number of things can go wrong. This is just insanity. And as you pointed out, it is a violation of the Criminal Code of Canada. So you're likely to be taking a ride if you do that, and you're apprehended. You're likely to be taking a ride in the back of a police cruiser.
Exactly. Now, I'm not a lawyer, but according to the information I received from a lawyer, Section 22 of the Criminal Code makes it illegal for someone to encourage someone else to break the law.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what's going on here.
It is. You also sent me a photograph of somebody who held up what looked like a professionally created sign that said "Legalize shoplifting." I'm sorry, but when exactly did the synapses totally disconnect? Do we have a national synapse disconnection day? Because I think we need it.
Well, the picture was taken on Quinpool, a well-known street in Halifax, and I did hide the faces of the people holding the sign because I could tell that a couple of them were minors. I mean, and this is the other issue about Reddit and all of these things. I mean, a lot of young folks, probably smart folks, are basically fed this idea that corporations are bad in the food business. And they're young citizens, and they're growing up. They're trying to figure out, you know, how the world works. And all these messages are just not good for them as they grow up and become responsible citizens.
No, and Mr. Singh, Jagmeet Singh, the leader of the federal NDP, has been going around for a long time now, verbally and on social media, accusing the big grocery chains of gouging the public. And eventually, I mean, you throw enough things at the wall, eventually something's going to stick.
Exactly. I saw a reporter from Hamilton, I think it was last week or the week before. She was actually sitting down with Jagmeet Singh, and it was from CHCH in Hamilton. She did a brilliant job. And in the first couple of minutes, she did ask two key questions. What does excess profit mean, really? And how do you... If you penalize grocers with a windfall tax, wouldn't everyone pay for it? I mean, those are the questions we need to ask more often to Jagmeet Singh and people who believe that corporations are just not doing their jobs.
Sylvain, thank you very much. I hated to interrupt you early on the Sunday. Well, I didn't actually. I always like to get in touch with you.
Oh, no. You never interrupt me, Roy.
No.
Don't worry about it.
That was a phony apology, and I apologize for the phony apology. Thank you. Thanks, Sylvain. Take care. Professor Sylvain Charlebois from Dalhousie University. He's the head of the Agri-Foods Lab at Dalhousie. What was that I said? Phony, was it a phony apology for a phony apology? That sounds like a Bill Clinton line. Okay. Look, I have a question for you. At 1-800-263-2428. 1-800-263-2428. So whoever these people are, they're calling for to organize a Steal from Loblaws Day on May the 12th. So my question to you is this. What's your reaction to that? What's your response to an attempt to organize a day of larceny or a day of looting, as I called it? What's your response to that? And here's the $60,000 question. Do you believe all of us have a responsibility to intercede if any theft occurs in our presence? So if we see a theft occurring in our presence, do we have a responsibility to intercede? You know, absence guns and threat to life. Start with Chris in Edmonton. How are you, Chris?
Hi, Roy. Very well, thank you. This is a symptom of a society, I think, reaching its breaking point, Roy. And I'm in Edmonton. So we've been seeing this for a long time, not just in the grocery industry, but at the liquor stores where people are just walking in, taking things, and walking out. At the Shoppers Drug Marts downtown where the same thing happens. And I think people are at the point where they're considering civil disobedience because for lots of reasons. People are stressed to the max. Corporations are gouging, and there's no government oversight or enforcement of...
So are you tacitly agreeing with it?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
I don't agree with any form of theft or looting. And we as Canadians, you asked the question, should we step in?
Yeah. Quick answer, yes, no.
Yeah, you know, not if your safety is going to be put in jeopardy.
Okay.
You vote and report it.
No, I understand that. And I fully concur, fully agree with you, Chris. Thank you very much for the call. Let's go to Frank in Ancaster, Ontario. Frank, when there's a call for a national day of... You know, shoplifting or looting, as I'm calling it. How do you react? Hello, Frank.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
How do you react to that?
Well, I can just pretty well reiterate what the previous caller just said. And, you know, when I heard this, first of all, I was in disbelief. And then when I thought, what's going to be like to see all grocery stores with bars and chains, and, you know, just like we see in the United States in some areas.
Well, Frank, you're in Ontario. If you go to an LCBO, the Liquor Control Board of Ontario stores, and you look for scotch, which isn't, you know, the less expensive stuff, just the moderately expensive stuff, it's all behind lock and key because they get shoplifted every day.
You know what else is behind lock and key these days, Roy?
Mm-hmm.
I was, to my ultimate surprise, in the entire, they've got tools, like I'm talking about drills and wrenches and the like.
So if it's portable, it's gone.
You can't get in there and look to see whether it's the size you want until you get somebody coming with a key and they stand right behind you.
Yeah, we know But I don't blame the retailer, Frank. I don't blame the retailer.
Oh, absolutely.
If it's disappearing, you know, I said to you a minute ago, if it's portable, it's gone. Thank you for the call, Frank, from Ancaster. Greg is in Vancouver. Greg, what do you make of it?
Oh, come on. I grew up in the 60s and 70s. My parents were from the Great Depression. They had nothing growing up. And my old man came from a totally broken household, never stole a thing in his life.
Yeah.
And if he caught me doing, he'd break my arm. Come on.
I hear what you're saying. When we're kids, I mean, we all have stories about, not all of us, but some of us, have kids of stories of stealing a candy bar. I did. And then my dad caught...
Or an apple out of the neighbor's tree. I mean, come on.
Yeah, no. But I was eating the candy bar at the house. I was 6 years old. And my dad said, where'd you get that? At the store. You don't have any money. How'd you? Well, I just picked it up and I went. Okay, son, we're going back to the store. Lesson taught, lesson learned. But when you have a national call for a day of looting.
Unbelievable.
It is, isn't it? Should be.
Unbelievable.
Thank you.
Can you imagine if you brought that forward in Chicago or New York? You talk about bad cities, but. They're bad cities. But you know what? Not bad. They're actually nice cities with a problem. But, you know, Vancouver, it's in comparison now.
Yeah, gotta go, bud. Thank you very much, Greg in Vancouver. And then there was the federal budget. Now look, most often when a federal budget is delivered, if it's 2 days afterward, I'm not touching it. Because for most people, it's caught between the hoe and the hum. So 48 hours after the budget's been delivered, Roy's not going there. Not because I don't want to, but because I know you don't want to. And because I know you're looking at it and you're hearing them and you're saying, oh, their lips are moving, they must be lying. Let's just call it what it is. But this budget is something a little bit different and a little bit special. And so... I just called it online earlier today. I called it a prime jewel of financial misfires. The Business Council of Canada, they're very careful about what they say when it comes to the federal government because it really they represent the largest companies in this country. By the way, the largest companies are not the enemy. They create employment. They grow the economy. So the response from Goldie Hyder, President and Chief Executive Officer of the BCC, Business Council of Canada, he's been on this program many times. Mr. Hyder says the 2024 federal budget holds back Canada's potential. The tax and spend fiscal plan will discourage the economic growth necessary to improve living standards. It deters the business investment that helps boost wages and places a greater debt burden on future generations. The federal government's inability to make choices and rein in spending will have a negative impact on the lives and livelihoods of all Canadians, says the Business Council of Canada President and CEO Goldie Hyder. So, we spoke yesterday with Dr. David Poon, who told us that the the budget is causing him and other doctors great unease. And they're starting a letter-writing campaign. So let's get at this. And we're going to speak with our good friend, Professor Eric Kam, macroeconomics professor at Toronto Metropolitan University. So, Dr. Kam, here we have this budget. And honestly, even if it had been brought down yesterday and it was another one of those typical budgets, you and I wouldn't be talking about it today. We might be talking about something else. Well, let's talk about this budget because it is receiving two thumbs down. You know the rule of the Colosseum in Rome? Two thumbs up, good show. Two thumbs down, goodbye. So what's your assessment? Before we get into the details, what's your overall assessment of what was delivered?
Hi, Roy. My overall assessment is that there's only so many ways you can package garbage. And it really brought me to back to when I was a kid in the 1970s. One of my favorite TV commercials was when Ricardo Montalban introduced fine Corinthian leather until we found out that that wasn't a thing. Exactly. And neither is generational fairness, and neither is this budget. So you said somewhere between ho and hum. I think this thing is somewhere, Roy, between oh and no.
I remember that Corinthian leather commercial for the Chryslers of the day, and people went out and they bought cars because they had Corinthian leather, and then we found out it doesn't exist. And it was marketing, and that's what this was an attempt to accomplish. But it's just a terrible failure. But it's also, would you agree that it's dangerous in its structure to the well-being of all Canadians?
Yeah, I would say that because it goes against, well, two things, really, and I'm glad you brought that up. I may be a little verbose on this, but there's two things that I hate. I hate lying. I never lie to my students. I don't lie to my children, and I for sure don't lie to your listeners because I respect them. And it goes against what I think is just good, sensible economics. And so for me, the lies, you've already brought up already the housing numbers. I mean, it's impossible. I mean, what kind of a dream is this, Roy? They're going to build this number of millions of homes in this short a period of time. I mean, you've addressed this already, so I feel like I don't have to pull this one apart. So I think I'll just pull apart their dream about the deficit numbers, right? It's expected, they said, to ease from $40 billion this year to $20 billion in 2029. Based on what data? This government, better than any other government in history, is a tried and true liberal tax and spend government. And the only way to do that is one of two things, unless you're really cursed. One of two is increased taxes, and the other one is increase the deficit. This government has driven it right up the middle, and it's done both. And so they're coming out with ridiculous, ridiculous pie in the sky numbers. And that offends me, Roy. So the reason that I think it's dangerous, we can get into in a second, just in terms of economics, but I don't like lying. And you and I both know that they're not going to be around in 2029 to answer for these numbers. But with respect to housing and with respect to the deficit, this is baloney.
So tell us, please, about the danger factor.
So here's my problem, and I think I've made this very, very, very clear, that Canada's productivity and its GDP growth, let's not mince words, Roy, they're abysmal. They're not bad, they're abysmal, right? Productivity in this country is increasing at about 0.3% since 2019. That's effectively zero. And just to compare, the U.S. is almost at about 2% annually. And I think one of the big problems, we've discussed this, is low investment in our country, right? So our government has sort of doubled down on this poorly, and they've said, well, let's try intellectual property. Let's try investing in that, right? Well, first of all, it's three times larger in the U.S. compared to Canada. You might want to just say, well, that's just because of the population base, but I don't know about that. But I found nothing in this budget that increases productivity or increases GDP growth. And I find, Roy, and I'll try to be quick about this, is the war that gets fought sometimes in this country between the Bank of Canada and the government is exacerbated. And I pulled out three things to tell you. The first one I just did. These high taxes will not be beneficial to investment. We need investment. We don't have it. Higher taxes is going to do nothing towards it. Number two, Freeland comes out ridiculously and says that now we're going to create conditions for interest rates to fall. Really? What conditions? Did you achieve them? Because you haven't yet, and nothing's fallen. And if GDP and the productivity levels stay where they are, they're not going to fall. So that's number two. Lastly, their fiscal plan, as they said, rests on the shoulders of a steadily expanding economy, even if modest. Roy, I know what modest means. I would kill for modest. There's no modest. There's no expansion. So to me, this is on a three-legged stool where all three legs are about to snap. And I just wonder if the government now believes people will buy any of the garbage that they're selling. But frankly, unlike them, I think Canadians are too smart.
It's a desperation budget. I think they're grasping at straws and praying and hoping that something is going to stick, particularly with younger voters, and will make them more appealing. Mr. Trudeau addressed his caucus earlier this week, and he said that he was setting a date, I think it was July, to claw back 5 points in national polling from the hole they're in versus the Conservatives. So I read that, and I say to myself, okay, so it's not sincere. You're not really trying to help Canada. You're trying to help yourself. You're trying to help yourself and your party, and you want to get yourself back into power. If he'd said something like, hey, look, we may not get reelected again. Well, that's redundant. We may not get reelected, but we're going to do everything we can do to help Canadians and help Canada. That's the message that people will hear, and that's the message that will resonate. But we'll see if we can't get back 5 points in the polling deficit we're in by July. That just has disingenuous written all over it.
So. Yeah, and I'll tell you what else is disingenuous too, was their lack suddenly. And I don't know if anybody realized what was not in this budget. And their minimum tax got dropped because they know that that's stupidly unpopular, plus the fact it doesn't work. But I like the fact of how little they discussed suddenly, Roy, the green policy, the green agenda. They hardly discussed it.
Yeah.
And I don't care what anyone says. That may have been behind closed doors where they went, this is killing us, probably killed us. So we better make a sharp right turn, because I was amazed that suddenly this wasn't the focus anymore. So it's a bit like throwing a Hail Mary, as you said. They ran that play. It didn't go anywhere. Let's try taking a shot at housing and deficit numbers. But I'm telling you, Roy, their projections will never come true. You and I will be here to talk about it, but they won't.
Dr. Cam, another issue in that budget, and we spoke with the doctor yesterday, is the capital gains tax hike. It's supposed to target large corporations and the super wealthy, and yet family doctors are pushing back, because the interest or the increase in capital gains is going to hit them very hard when it comes time to sell their investments and get into retirement mode, which is not what they had expected. This hike isn't what they'd expected, and it will hurt doctors badly. And if doctors are hurt, patients are hurt.
You know, Roy, it's going to hurt doctors, it's going to hurt dentists, it's going to hurt lots of what I call medium to medium large size businesses. And not to be repetitive, but it's just another lie. Like when he talks about what was this budget, to me, this budget was a plan to satisfy the NDP, to keep them on board in terms of their fill in the blank before the word care, health, dental, pharma, day. That's all it's doing. They're just not being honest with people. They're not saying what the real realities are of this budget, which is it helps, honest to God, nobody. It is just an attempt, a feeble attempt, to do what liberal governments have done for years, just on a bigger level. Let's see how much we can tax and how much we can spend and see if that will prop up our economy. Because so far, the only thing we've done to prop up the economy is to use immigration as a growth strategy. And that's failed. And we know the Bank of Canada's platform during the COVID mess, that has failed. And so there's a lot of failure to spread around here. And so, again, I look for two things, right? You know me, I like GDP growth, and I like making taxpayers, consumers, whatever you want to call them, better off. And I see zero in this budget to make most people better off. At the margins, you may make some people better off. But as this government tends to do, it is going to cast the net widely for who's going to pay more taxes with no increased benefit. And by the way, finally, as they throw to you, but our debt to GDP ratio isn't as bad as it could be. Just remember that, because I think that might be on the gravestone of this government, not as bad as it could be.
Our text line is 877-399-9898, and I have a text from Welland, Ontario, and it reads, "Hey, I've got an idea. Let's sell Germany, Japan, and Greece, etc., the gas and oil they all want to buy." And then I remember that we had the Chancellor of Germany, the Prime Minister of Japan, the Prime Minister of Greece were all here, and they were looking for liquid natural gas. And the Prime Minister of this country said there's no business case to be made for the export of natural gas. So here, let me just pat you on the bum and send you home with the vague promise of hydrogen power coming your way from Canada at some point in the future. So we actually had the reality of purchasers, potential purchasers, ready to spend billions of dollars coming here, approaching the seller and being sent home. Professor Kam, I got to go. Thank you very much for the time.
Roy, happy, healthy Passover, and stay healthy, my friend. And
happy, healthy Passover to you.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you want to hear more, subscribe to The Roy Green Show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorites. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review and tell a friend. I'm Roy Green. Have a great weekend.